Hi, it's Diane. On my mind,
a pedophilia epidemic. That is how a new lawsuit describes the problem of child sex abuse in the Boy Scouts of America.
Revelations of sexual abuse in the Boy Scouts. In the wake of the Me Too movement, children who experienced sexual abuse are coming forward with their stories and demanding the adults and institutions responsible be held accountable. New statute of limitation laws are helping their effort. The Boy Scouts is one of the organizations facing new lawsuits. Tim Kosnoff is an attorney representing many of the victims. He explained to me why hundreds have contacted him and what he wants to see done to hold the Boy Scouts accountable. Tim Kosnoff, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to take you back to December. I gather you read an article at that time that says the Boy Scouts of America was planning to file for bankruptcy. What did you think? You were on the verge of retirement when you saw this.
Well, I thought that my retirement was probably coming to an end. Huh. And that I would be diving back into the breach because I recognized immediately what they were planning on doing.
Tell me why. Give us a little background.
Well, I've been representing survivors of child sexual abuse for more than 25 years and exclusively since approximately 2001. And I practiced in the state of Washington, which had a favorable statute of limitations for child sexual abuse survivors, and it was really almost unique in the country. And as a result, I was able to have this law practice representing survivors in civil actions against perpetrators and against institutions that enable them. So I've probably represented in excess of 2,000 clients since then, many of whom were victims of clergy sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. And so I was involved in representing survivors in bankruptcies in the Diocese of Spokane, Washington, Helena and Great Falls, Billings, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the Jesuits of the Pacific Northwest, etc. And so while I never planned on becoming as acquainted with the intricacies of bankruptcy law, that's what happened. And so I recognized what the Boy Scouts were doing. They intended to move all of this into the shadows of the bankruptcy court, where it would be highly unlikely that the public would ever become aware of who the perpetrators are in the Boy Scouts of America.
I see.
And since I'd been tracking them for so many years, I knew that it was an enormous problem.
So was it at that point you created the organization Abused in Scouting?
That's right. It was shortly after the new year, and two other law firms that I had worked with in the past met with them and told them what I was proposing, and they agreed. And we put together something that hadn't been done before, which was a national television advertising campaign run on a small budget. And I didn't know exactly what would happen, but the response was overwhelming, and we continue to be inundated.
What did the television ad say?
It said that if you were abused in scouting, you should come forward and protect the community and identify your abuser and to get, you know, the help and healing that you deserve.
Had there, up until that point, had there been a lot of litigation?
There had been around the country, and I had handled probably more than 100 cases against the Boy Scouts of America, but it was really just, I think, a drop in the ocean compared to what we've uncovered.
I gather you heard from nearly 1,000 men. Tell me about who they are and what kinds of stories they told you.
Well, they come from all over the country, 48 states, two territories. They come from all walks of life. They are everything from blue-collar workers to CEOs. They come from all kinds of socioeconomic backgrounds. They really are a reflection of America itself. We have Hispanics and African Americans and Asian people, everybody who thought that to be a good American, you needed to join this organization and that it exemplified the best of what the United States of America is.
And Tim, tell me how old they are.
Our youngest is 14 and our oldest is 89.
So what you're indicating by telling me about that young man as well as the older one, it's been going on for a long time and it's still going on.
It is. This began even before the Boy Scouts of America was officially organized in the United States and created by an act of Congress in 1916. They admitted that by 1935, they had thousands of files of individuals who had molested children and kept it secret and continued to open up files. They had so many files that by the 1970s, they started destroying the files and they kept no destruction log. But our estimates are that they had at one time 40 to 50,000 perversion files, which is another word for ineligible volunteer files, of which approximately 8,000 survive. We are asked all the time how many men were abused in scouting. How many molesters are there in scouting? And the truth is, we don't know. When we ask the Boy Scouts of America, we can't get an answer out of them. When reporters ask the Boy Scouts of America, they get these canned answers that don't answer the question. So there are so many questions we don't know how to answer. But I believe that there were probably somewhere in the order of 75 to 100,000 molesters in scouting, and as many as 1.5 million boys, men, were abused in scouting.
Wow.
Really just staggering numbers.
Yes.
But
yes.
It brings us back to the question and the answer. The Boy Scouts of America has never had to answer these questions, and the only entity that has the ability to force the Boy Scouts of America to answer these questions is the United States Congress.
I see. So how was the organization itself, the Boy Scouts of America, dealing with these reported cases of abuse?
Well, they haven't. They had this remarkable collection of data that they'd been keeping for over 100 years.
Records.
That's right. And what they had, Diane, was really unique. Even the FBI didn't have anything like this, which was a criminological database on a particular type of criminal offender. The FBI didn't start tracking and doing this kind of research until the 1980s. So the Boy Scouts kept it secret. They didn't report it. They didn't disclose it to Congress. And they treated it as if it was an existential threat, which it was, because if it had gotten out that there were these kinds of risks to boys in scouting, it would jeopardize the very existence of the program and its funding by the American taxpayer and its support by corporate America. So they covered up, and they continue to cover up.
Well, explain this to me. There was this so-called list of ineligible volunteers that the Boy Scouts developed in regard to those they either found out or suspected of abusing young boys. How did that work?
Typically, it was a sort of reactive measure. They would, get a report. Typically, it would be somebody would spot a newspaper article that a leader of a troop in a local council or local community had been arrested and charged, and they would transmit that information to the Boy Scout headquarters in Irving, Texas, and they would open up a file. But we have many instances where it was reported in the local press, but they never opened up a perversion file, and the person was still allowed to continue in scouting, despite the fact that they'd been arrested, prosecuted, and convicted of child molestation. So if it was a mechanism for protecting children, it was an utter failure. And here's a disturbing fact. over 90% of the men that are contacting us are identifying abusers that have never appeared in the perversion files and have never been otherwise publicly identified. So what these men are doing who are coming forward and contacting us are identifying the predators in our communities. But it also points up that if the Boy Scouts represent that there's 8,000 files presently, and if you consider that they opened up a file one every other day since 1916, you're coming up with just mind-boggling numbers, because you, whatever that number is, 50,000 files, you have to multiply it by nine-tenths, because that's how many are actually in scouting, because we know that from the 1,000 men that have come forward and identified those perpetrators to us. So whatever the numbers are, we don't know, but it's obviously massive.
Can you give an example of how this kind of abuse would occur? I mean, we think of the Boy Scouts meeting together in troops with a Boy Scout leader, a volunteer, all in public, but you're telling me that this kind of abuse may have been going on behind closed doors.
There's a multi-pronged answer to your question. One is that it's a unique organization in the way it's structured, with the Scoutmaster having a sort of quasi-military authority over young boys, loyalty oaths, and a system of advancement that's based upon satisfying the Scoutmaster that, you know, you deserve to receive a merit badge. So to young boys, the whole system of rewards was powerful. Then you have this system where you basically have men about which you know absolutely nothing about taking your boys out in the wilderness or out in the woods overnight, sometimes for many nights, and you know virtually nothing about that man, nothing. The reason is the Boy Scouts of America, with their, you know, $600 million a year in revenue, put the responsibility for vetting scout leaders on the moms and dads that organize and oversee the troops. And these moms and dads don't know anything about the nature of pedophilia, the warning signs. They haven't received any training, and they certainly didn't receive any money. I mean, this is the kind of thing that, you know, in most organizations, they have human resources departments that are funded to do what they call double beat background checks. But the Boy Scouts resisted even doing criminal background checks until they were forced to in about 2012. So when a case arises, the Boy Scouts of America says, well, it's not our fault. Blame the moms and dads. They were the ones that hired the volunteer.
So give me an example of how a young boy would be sexually abused. How would the volunteer or the scout leader gather the privacy needed to carry that out?
We see that done in, you know, remarkably consistent ways, the obvious ways. They would crawl into the boy's tent at night and molest the child. They would groom the parent and the child so that they could get the child alone, ostensibly for something like, you know, merit badge training. The boy wants to get his swimming merit badge, so the adult volunteer picks the boy up, takes him for the day, and takes him back to his apartment, abuses him in his car. We're finding active pedophile rings operating, where you've got one boy who's being molested by multiple adults. So that's basically the context, which is it was trust that was completely misplaced. And parents just assumed that the representations in the branding efforts of the Boy Scouts of America to wrap itself in mom, apple pie, and the American flag and all of these symbols of Americanism.
Norman Rockwell,
absolutely. That, you know, that this was a safe and wholesome place to entrust your boys.
Indeed.
When it was just the opposite.
Are we talking about pedophilia on the part of paid Boy Scout leaders, or are we talking about abuse on the part of only volunteers?
Well, this is a great question. What we're finding is that approximately 5% or 1 in 20 of the abusers were themselves paid professional scouters. In other words, these were men that were hired by the Boy Scouts of America or one of the Boy Scouts of America's local consuls or camp directors. You know, they came up through the scouting system and they were employed by the organization. And in fact, the most telling, back in around 2004, the man that the Boy Scouts of America put in charge of the Scout Safety Program to protect kids from sexual abuse was himself arrested and prosecuted and convicted for possessing hundreds of thousands of images of child porn.
Who was
His name was
that?
Douglas Smith.
Douglas Smith.
So how on earth does a man like this get into that kind of position? And what does it tell us about how extensive pedophiles have risen or have become enmeshed in the professional organization itself? Again, these are questions that Congress, with its subpoena power, needs to get the answers to.
And thus far, what has been your effort and your success or lack thereof with members of Congress?
In 2012, I was able to get a meeting with the Republican chair of the House Judiciary Committee, Lamar Smith of Texas, and the ranking member, John Conyers, the Democrat of Michigan. And I would say that Conyers was interested, supportive, and wanted to help. But of course, he was in the minority and was powerless. And Lamar Smith had absolutely no interest. He just had no interest in listening. So I don't want to make this a partisan issue, but and I know that there are Republicans who care about this issue. I don't think it has to be partisan, but the Boy Scouts have been insulated politically, and I look at the Republican Party and their unquestioning allegiance and support to the Boy Scouts of America.
A short break. More from Tim Kuznoff when we return.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here is the rest of my conversation with Tim Kuznoff. He's an attorney who's litigated sexual abuse cases for 25 years. He launched Abused in Scouting this past spring. Tim, there is a question of, did parents ever report these allegations to the police at the time? And if so, what happened then?
There is evidence in the files that parents did report, and oftentimes that was how the file came to be, which was that it originated with the parent reporting to the police. But more often than not, when a parent reported to the Boy Scouts of America, the Boy Scouts of America did not report it to the police and actively worked to convince the parent that it wouldn't be in the child's best interest for this to be reported to the police. So the overall pattern is the Boy Scouts of America did not comply with the mandated reporting laws and instead sought to deal with this quietly internally. More often than not, they would approach the perpetrator, the accused perpetrator, and convince him to resign and to move on, and they would make no accusations. This allowed the perpetrator to simply move to a different youth-serving organization, or in many instances, move to a different town and rejoin the Boy Scouts of America, a different troop, under an altered name, maybe change a middle initial, because the registration itself had very little identifying information. Huh. No photograph, no social security number, no means of really, you know, identifying this person except by their name. So it was so easy for an individual to simply alter their name and get past this perversion file system that the Boy Scouts had set up.
So, after all these years, why do you think that these men and boys are finally willing to come forward?
I think there's been a cultural turning point in this country, whether it's the Me Too movement or Epstein or Cosby or Larry Nassar and women's gymnastics. People feel that if they come forward now, they'll be believed, that they don't have to live in shame, that what happened to them was not their fault, that they were children, and that responsible adults who should have been protecting them failed them. And I think that's all coming together. Interesting to me, because I've been handling sexual abuse cases for so long, that in the case of these men, they seemed to need a particularized message to them, because we hear responses like, I've been watching the Catholic clergy cases, and I've been watching these other cases, and I was waiting for the day when somebody would speak directly to me and my experience. And that was a revelation, because I would have thought that people would have transferred hearing about an experience of being abused by a priest to their experience in Boy Scouts, but it hasn't.
Tell me now about the new statute of limitations and how that could affect those older men who recall being abused.
Well, this is also a reflection of a shift in the political environment. In the last election, many state houses, legislatures around the country, which had been controlled, at least in part, by the Republican Party, blocked efforts at giving victims an opportunity to come forward, identify their abuser by filing a lawsuit. And finally, New York passed. It had been pending for decades. And so the New York window statute opened up, which happened just last week. And now hundreds of people are coming forward and identifying their abusers and holding institutions accountable. What that means is that no matter how long ago you were abused, and even if you've been told that it was too late for justice for you, well, that's changed. The laws have changed. Same in New Jersey, goes effective December 1st. California has a bill. It hasn't passed yet, but it's looking like it will. It'll become effective January 1st. And similar bills have passed around the country.
What will these new laws allow these men to do?
Well, in New York State, for example, they have a one-year look-back window so they can hire a lawyer and file a lawsuit and identify their perpetrator. And thereafter, in New York, the statute of limitations for civil actions is age 55, which is significant because we know that men don't disclose their abuse until, on average, age 52. Huh. So it takes that long for them to process it and come to the point where they can confront these memories and deal with them. So that's hugely important, because these statute of limitations laws before locked these people out of the courthouse. Their case would be subject to immediate dismissal.
So, Tim, how have the Boy Scouts reacted to all of this revelation and to the new statute of limitation laws?
They lobbied these state legislatures not to pass these new laws, spent millions of dollars on lobbyists. This is a taxpayer-funded organization, and they're using taxpayer money to try and defeat rights of victims. So that failed, and now they've been sort of hunkered down in their bunker. We contacted them this spring and said, we are uncovering hundreds and hundreds of previously unidentified perpetrators. you're responsible for reporting these. And they said that they would, but it's been insufficient. They've not really done anything meaningful to get these perpetrators reported to local law enforcement. They've basically pushed it back on us, which are a few small law firms, to notify hundreds and hundreds of police departments and communities all over the country. And we get these communications from the Boy Scouts saying it's just, it's too expensive, it's too cumbersome, and we're going to just, you know, do what we can, but we're not promising anything.
So, Tim, if the Boy Scouts do successfully declare bankruptcy, would that be the end of the organization and thereby the end of lawsuits that could be brought against the organization?
I don't know whether it will be the end of the Boy Scouts of America. They would file Chapter 11 seeking to reorganize free of the claims of all of these men to clear the liabilities. During that process, victims would have a period of time to come forward and file claims in the bankruptcy against the Boy Scouts. But at the end of that claims period, if they hadn't filed a claim, they'd be forever barred from bringing a lawsuit or claim against the Boy Scouts of America. So that's their goal, is to stop this and to marshal their assets to pay the claims. And whether they have sufficient assets and insurance to even come out of bankruptcy reorganized as the new Boy Scouts of America or whatever name they take, I don't know. But it's going to be a massive undertaking, a bankruptcy like that, because it's not just the Boy Scouts of America National, but all of the local councils around the country, of which there are hundreds, who are also implicated in this case, and all the sponsoring organizations, many of which are well known, the Catholic Church, the Mormon Church, and other religious organizations that would have legal exposure.
I'm sure that there are many boys, young men, older men, who've had an extremely positive experience with the Boy Scouts. So to see that organization go down completely might be rather sad for a good number of people.
Well, it is, but parents have other options, safer options for their boys. It doesn't have to be the Boy Scouts of America, and I think there has to be a complete house cleaning and a re-examination of the whole Boy Scout system and program. And so what would emerge, if it emerges at all, would be something that would be different. And whether such an organization could continue to exist under a new model, which would involve a different economic model, I don't know. But this points up the need for a more comprehensive examination by the public through its congressional representatives than what will happen in bankruptcy, which will happen largely away from the view of the public.
So exactly what do you want to see Congress do?
Congress needs to get answers. It needs to bring leaders, past and present, from the Boy Scouts of America before its committee. It needs to subpoena documents. It has an army of congressional researchers in the basement that could dig into these files and understand the full scope of the problem, identify the causes, identify those within the organization that concealed and covered up and conspired to cover up, and bring victims before the committee to hear firsthand their experiences, to talk to experts in the field of child protection, and essentially educate themselves as to what is needed. It may be that Congress concludes that Congress, the American public, should not be involved in this organization at all, and that it should revoke its charter, its congressional charter, and liquidate it, terminate it.
And finally, is there a number that people can call if they, too, want to talk about their own experiences with the Boy Scouts?
The phone number is 1-888-99-SCOUT. We have social workers, people who are sensitive to these kinds of callers, and have really done a fabulous job at helping them come to terms. Many of these men, Diane, have never told anybody what happened to them. We have men in their late 80s who break down sobbing, and they've never told anybody about what happened after, you know, and they've kept this inside for all these years. So being exposed to this is triggering. It's traumatic. It's painful. It's potentially dangerous for them. So it's very important that they have the ability to speak to somebody immediately that understands what they're saying and can give them some help and guidance.
Thank you so, so much, Tim, for being with us. This has really been quite revelatory, and I hope we'll help lots of people, young and old.
Thank you so much.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Douglas Bell and Josephine Neonai. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.